guest this week is a journalism and broadcasting pro and a leading voice in Indigenous podcasting. He was born and raised in Winnipeg and is a citizen of the Peter Ballantine Cree Nation, located in what's currently known as Northern Saskatchewan. See you. What I did there?
Yeah, I love it.
For more than 20 years, he's had a career in media, beginning at Carleton University's CKCU-FM in Ottawa, and following that at CBC Radio, APTN, and NCI-FM. He was also the host and producer of Urban Nation Live.
That's right.
Yeah, on Winnipeg Streets 104.7 FM.
This is your life, Rick Harp.
In February 2010, he launched the online magazine Media Indigena, a weekly roundtable offering Indigenous perspectives on current affairs. And here's a little piece of trivia. He was also the co-author of an Aboriginal Healing Foundation publication.
That's
do you
right.
remember that?
Yes, I
2009.
Do.
Snappy title here, The Lump Sum Compensation Payments Research Project.
That's right. That's right. That was quite the project.
Rick Harp, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I looked it up, you know, that was our first conversation. It was 15 years ago, God. January 10th, 2003. How about that?
You're aging me right here.
We're probably the same vintage, right? Born in the 60s, mid-60s?
1968, yeah.
Okay, there you go. So we're going to compare notes
okay,
today.
Good.
That's what we're going to do. That's my plan.
All right.
I thought, should we do that? Should we talk shop? Will that be boring? But who cares what the audience thinks, Rick, right?
That's right. You know, all I care about are my, it's funny. This has come up lately. Like, who do you work for? And how do you approach it? And, there's many different ways to get at that question. Because on the one hand, my first brain wave was, I'm going to play to my audience, my existing audience, and even further in there, live to serve at the pleasure, I suppose, of my patrons. I use a crowdfunding platform called Patreon, where people, on a monthly basis, invest at whatever level they care to or are able to to support the work that I do with my fellow roundtablers on Media Indigena. So in a way, sometimes I think, what would they like to do? What would they like to hear, rather? But on the other hand, there are many more listeners week to week or month to month rather than there are patrons. So maybe that's the second concentric circle that I'm trying. And then beyond that, the people I hope to attract. So it's actually like, who do you serve?
Do you have any sense of that?
It's blowing my mind.
Your audience? Do you get emails and stuff like people stop you in the street?
No. just the police. No. I love your podcast. Actually, I got stopped once in Regina at a spot check. Like, it was supposed to be random. And they're just like, hey, sir, what have you been up to tonight? And I said, wouldn't you like to know? And then I just said, we're just out and having out and about. I just had supper. I think I had one beer or something like that. And he said, okay, well, this is just a spot check to see how you're doing. And he said, hey, I think I recognize you. You're on APTN, right? In that way, it was a benign, thankfully, interaction with the police. But, most of the responses I get are, retweets on Twitter or likes on Facebook, sometimes comments, sometimes emails. Whether it's just sort of a general way to go or I want to respond to this particular piece of your program. So yeah, no, it's growing, as the audience grows, as the patronage grows, I'm seeing more and more of a response, which I think theoretically means we're growing the audience, everything.
Let's hear a little clip of your show.
Ooh, okay.
On this week's roundtable, the change the date debate. We'll discuss what seems to have been the most controversial Australia Day yet. Plus, divine intervention? As the Chilean government turns up the heat, why would the Pope push the Mapuche to turn the other cheek? And bison on the brink? It's an animal many still revere. Now a scientist raises fresh concern about its future. This week's episode is...
Can you see why I picked that clip? It's got lots of alliteration.
Yeah, guilty as charged. I can't break that habit, and sometimes I do it to a fault, but...
It sounds pro. It sounds like a guy who's been doing this for a while. Well, how do I get that voice?
Those quick, snappy openers. Because, my approach going in is that someone's going to make a decision in that first minute.
Yeah, am I sticking around for this?
Yeah, or not? And so I want to give a flavor of it. I want to give a flavor of the show because I'm assuming, as I mentioned earlier, there's more audience to come and to acquire, as it were. And so I'm always on trial or always on audition, I suppose.
Yeah. How were you as a kid growing up? I'll tell you how I was. I bet this is you. All right. I'm going to take a guess. So I'm like 10 years old, right? Okay. And the most amazing thing in the world are typewriters and shoebox cassette recorders. And I had one of each. When I was in grade 4, I started a newspaper and passed it around the school and made little things on my tape recorder there. Then I went to high school.
Yeah.
I owned a Gestetner when I was 13. My parents bought me. Remember those?
No, I remember the name.
But you crank it and the computer that comes out, it's like purple text.
Yes.
Well, it has that smell.
My school had it. I loved that. It was so tactile. It was like, but
everyone would sniff it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then there'd be detentions. But
get high. That was sort of your life when you were growing up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I
rehearsed. In your bedroom.
Slightly different, but for essentially the same. I love to do comic books. It's funny, I had a friend reach out to me from elementary, like we were friends in elementary school, and his parents were in, or his dad was in the military, so he moved away. But we spent a good year, couple of years coming up with comic strips. We were heavily influenced by Charles Schulz. So, you know, started to develop a visual vocabulary that way. I mean, I would copy first and then evolve later, and that's the path of most artists, right? And so I was very into that, but then, I was always playing with my uncles and father's, really nice stereos. And I guess I broke a few cassettes. Remember those? And, they got so annoyed. They bought me one of those shoebox, cassette recorders. And I just went to town with that. I had a really good, friend named Eddie at that time. And he and I would do these elaborate skits. And then we bought another tape recorder so we could do sound effects on the one. And then,
Having two was the ultimate. Now you can,
multi-track, red style almost, right? I mean, in this urban red style. And, it was just amazing because there too, copying sketch comedy and stuff and coming up with, I'm sure one or two of those, you know, are around somewhere. And I would just love to just play them for my daughter, my 11-year-old. I mean, who didn't get to, you know, I mean, she gets to play with apps and stuff like that, but it's not the same thing. You know, it's not for some reason, and this is just my old man viewpoint here, but, you know, it seemed the analog hands-on, it seemed you had to work harder. So it felt like it meant more.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up in Winnipeg.
I certainly did, because that's where my mom ended up. She started in northern Saskatchewan and in a reserve community called South End, and that's part of the Peter Ballantyne Cree Nation. It's sort of like a constellation of communities that have integrated, which I understand the Justice Minister wants all First Nations to do. So they're ahead of the curve, but she was removed from her family, taken into three residential schools. The last one, which the building still stands today and is actually less than 15 minutes walk from my house. That's where she ended up. And so, you know, other things unfolded as they do when you are in a territory and you're almost adult age. And so she ended up having me there. And that's where I grew up. And I went away and ended up coming back, as so often is the case.
This is from your website, Media Indigena.
Okay.
We should promote that. Tell everyone.
Absolutely.
Everyone knows who you are. I'm sure my listeners probably all know who you are.
Oh, okay.
I have no idea who my listeners are, by the way. So here's what you wrote. What all this has to do with podcasting is simple. Freedom from filters, freedom from fear or favor for those who'd rather you just shut up and go away. Freedom from generic, safe, inane, middle of the road content. So where's that coming from exactly? Did you feel that stuff, any of that stuff in your corporate gigs there, some of the stuff? You don't have to name names, but you get bonus points if you do, just so you know.
That's right. Just, you know, this will be...
I get a lot of that stuff, and you and I have both worked for corporate media, and you just kind of knew. It's like, if I use this word or I say it this way, so an editor is going to tell me, maybe you should change it. That word seems kind of confrontational. Maybe we should try a different word, you know. Do you know what I mean?
I do, and yet...
It's more subtle than people think. I was never flat out told you can't say that. I'd let, you know, call somebody a dick or something, and they'd be like, well, you can't really do that. You can't call the prime minister a dick. Well, come on. I mean, I think he kind of is a dick.
I mean, if he walks like a dick, acts like a dick.
But it was always couched in that sort of way. It's like, that's kind of rude or, you know.
Yeah. You know what? But, okay, explain Margaret Wente to me then.
Exactly. Right? That's a shtick, I think.
Well, I do. I agree. But I think there's politically correct, political incorrectness. And then there's in politically correct or politically incorrect. And I'm trying to say it. I'm confusing myself here. But there's an acceptable way to be offensive and pushing the bounds. And then there's like, yeah, no, you can't even say that. You know, I mean, but then again, they know their audience. And I mean, in some ways, that's what that passage you quoted is getting at. I mean, I became quite aware at different places who is in my audience and who isn't considered to be the core of that audience. Indigenous people, you know, the numbers basically are evidence that they aren't the main audience for things. And so whenever I would approach something or listen to others approach a topic, even Indigenous topics ostensibly, it was clear it was through a white set of eyes, a white gaze, a white perspective. And so when I was asked to be part of a more mainstream outlet, one time I was told, you know, as actually sincere advice about how to approach a topic, and I actually hung on to it, but it had a double edge to it. And it was, think of the listener at home saying, what's in it for me? And I'm like, well, who's me? Who are all those me's? Most of those me's are non-Indigenous. Mm-hmm. And so what's in it for them is different. But that passage is also just talking about, you know, just the fluff that's out there, even on CBC morning shows, where they're kind of pretending to be like, we're part of your community. We really listen to what you have to say, you know? And I'm just like, I don't know. We're all really encouraged to put on these personas and like nod our heads when somebody's telling us their sob stories or, you know, ripping themselves apart on air. And then we're like, well, thank you very much. Looks like snow tomorrow. Get out your, you know, boots, right? And you're like, you just pivot on a dime. And it all just struck me as kind of artifice. And I mean, of course, that's in some ways the job description is making the unnatural sound natural. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think there's ways to get closer to that and more authentic human engagement. And then there's ways that, you know, we hear it. But then, you know, I think in some ways we don't have an array of options to be able to tell the difference. Everything seems to have kind of come down to a lowest common denominator in terms of how people should be. And everything has a time limit or it has parameters, you know, that it has to stay within to be recognizable. I mean, so many things about Indigenous people are radically different than what mainstream society is able to take in. And so if you're trying to introduce them, you're going to spend half your time trying to, like the irony is news is really all about the familiar, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, today person X was X violated by person Y, right? Like crime, right? And if it bleeds, it leads. And then there's weather and then there's traffic. Like so much of the morning show, I don't know why people listen anymore. Any morning show, I'm not singling any out. They've all become, whether it's CBC or music stations, it's become this sort of heavily routinized buffet, right? And it's just like, oh, great, scrambled eggs. Oh, good. You know, so.
Did you feel like you had to go out on your own to be authentic? You used the word authentic, and I think that's really gets to the heart of it.
Yeah.
Is that what it took?
I think so. I realized at the end of the day, like it was also, you know, part of it was just, you know, wanting to scratch an itch that had, I didn't realize could be scratched. I mean, podcasting, there's so much about it that is really basic. It's just radio except on demand. On the other hand, it's really the means of distribution that have revolutionized, that make podcasting, I think, potentially, you know, revolutionary, if only because of the costs of entry. The barriers to entry are pretty much non-existent. I mean, for anyone who's done radio and has reasonable technical skills, it's not quite falling off a log, but the learning curve is not very steep. Yeah, I think to be authentic, I mean, whatever that means in the end, I mean, just being able to say what you want in the way that you want it and let it speak for itself. And if there's an audience for it, it's a different type of audience. It's not geographically specific like a morning radio show is in a particular city or region. In some ways, it's like speaking to your kind of people across the planet. I'm trying to make the show that I wanted to hear and it wasn't. and thinking that there's at least 1,000 other people who feel the same way in the English-speaking world. So New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the United States, where indigenous populations are contending with settler colonial states. And I'm sure I'm probably leaving out quite a few, right? But those are the ones that always come to mind.
You're talking about stuff that's really going on in the news, right?
Yeah, that's actually where we, you know, it's meant to be a current affairs hot takes roundtable, but from the perspective of hopefully insightful, intelligent Indigenous people who are all about having a good time, right? Yeah. And having a smart time and having a fun time. And, you know, as it turns out, the other four roundtablers, only two of whom appear at a time with me. I'm the constant. And then, so it's Candace and Kim, and then it's Brock and Ken, although I'm looking to mix and match as we go forward. This has just become, like, you know, you heard it here first, the permanent lineup. Before, I was having different voices on to see what they thought of it and just to, you know, see if they liked it or not. I mean, and see if it was something they wanted to do 26 times a year, right? It's a lot of, we try to pick topics that they can speak to, but all these, we always want to speak to topics in a way that, you know, are grounded in a little bit of thought and thoughtfulness. And so that takes time to prepare. So Candace Collison has just joined us. So I'm hoping now to not necessarily always have the lineups the way it is, because it's interesting here how different people interact with each other.
You write somewhere that it says here, I'm driven by a core belief that stories can be truly life or death. And out of such consequences comes a cause to share stories which keep Indigenous peoples alive in every sense of the term. That's pretty heavy. That's pretty serious.
I know, eh?
Yeah.
Who wrote you that? I wrote that?
Yeah, that's a quote from you.
I know.
You're a serious guy.
I am. When I'm not being a brat, I'm being a serious guy. Yeah, no, I mean, I think the...
And it's a serious show.
It is mostly... it deals with serious shit. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, you're allowed to say
okay.
that. We have freedom on this show.
Yeah, we do. I mean, I remember I was at this Winnipeg Literary Festival, and they had an Indigenous speaker at the top of the block, and they introduced themselves by saying, you know, whenever I'm at a gathering like this talking about Indigenous issues, I always remind myself I'm not supposed to be here.
Yeah.
Right? The state, whether it's Canada or the United States or New Zealand or Australia, they were hell-bent on eradicating our peoples from the face of the planet. You know, it was funny because I was trying to come up with that mission statement or that value statement or vision statement, whatever you want to call it, all of the above. And I was really struggling. I was working with a friend on it, and she just said, like, you got to dig deep on this. And so I'm glad she did, because I remembered that. And then everything just flowed from there. Like, I mean, that's what I mean when it's life or death. Like, people need to understand our situation lest they continue to treat us in such a way that marginalizes us, that keeps us dispossessed, that keeps us on the current social cultural footing that we are, socioeconomic cultural footing that we are, and with such horrible, relative to the general population, health outcomes, you know, speaking at a population level. And, you know, I feel that the status quo, as I say in that piece later, is literally deadening and destroying us. You know, media, we have talked on the show about media's complicity in colonialism, in maintaining colonialism, in steering the conversation away from colonialism. Yeah. And we have to name it, you know, and to do that on mainstream outlets, there was just no space for it. I'd sound like I'm some raving Che Guevara wannabe, right? Mm-hmm. And there was very few opportunities to get in there. And the only time you could talk about Indigenous issues was often from a perspective of pity, and you'd be complicit in the pathologization of Indigenous people, right? And because, you know, it's one thing to note these statistics, it's another thing to try and understand the root causes behind them. But when you have at most 6 minutes on a typical CBC morning show to get into something, where's the room for that?
So I think people are souring on reconciliation. Indigenous people, at least, have soured on reconciliation.
The most recent episode, as we're recording this one, we talked about how Saskatchewan students have just said, we're done with this. We're not going to just, you know, be co-opted here or give you...
Be part of an economy of reconciliation.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, for that University of Saskatchewan, yeah.
I really love what's happening with APTN, and it's interesting that it's a growing media organization at a time when everybody's shrinking, and they're opening up new offices.
Yeah, no, it's...
There are jobs.
Yeah, that's right. It's heartening to see that 18 years later, APTN, as you say, is not just around. They're actually expanding and including into another medium. I mean, they've won two licenses for radio stations in Ottawa and Toronto, and there's three other licenses that were up for grabs, a total of five, kind of coming out of the ashes of Aboriginal Voices Radio. And we have the web, and we have podcasting, mm-hmm. and all that jazz. And
I notice you say we.
Do we? Yeah. Well, you said well, it
you
first.
In regard to APT, you're on contract.
Yeah,
with
I
them,
guess I should mention that. Yeah,
I don't know to what degree you think of yourself right now as APTN or as an APTN.
Oh, I definitely. Yeah, no. When I'm working on APTN stuff, I'm Mr. APTN. And yeah. So, I'm co-producing a series of documentaries with Tim Fontaine, who's been on this program.
Yeah.
And only in this case, he's dead serious about our work. Impossible. Never. And that's why I love working with him. And right now we're working on a documentary about Idle No More. And this actually represents a phenomenal opportunity for me. And they're very excited to get into this. We're digging through the archives of APTN and bringing those, you know, re-leveraging those, as they say, and taking advantage of the fact that APTN was the media outlet of note on that, you know, I think, in terms of first getting on its radar. Yeah. And so we're going to take that footage and we're going to weave it into an awesome narrative. We have so much material that we're not sure if we're just going to do it as a 48 minute or even longer or a series. That's how much.
How far great into stuff. This are you?
Well, next week, we're going to Ottawa to interview a number of people who we're going to get to reflect on the events that they happened, sometimes because they were covering them, sometimes like we're going to talk to Hayden King because he was both observing and participating in it. And we just want to find out, like, what was that all about? Where has it taken us? Where does it fit into the larger history of Indigenous resistance? And how did it change things in a way that will never go back to what came before? So lots of fascinating questions 5+ years hence.
Was there anything that come out of that that stuck out for you doing this documentary or so far doing it? Thought, wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. Did you have any of those moments? You usually do.
I was struck by how transformative it was, not just for the founders, but for everybody. And, you know, it's a cliche to talk about the what social media enables you to do, but it really was a galvanizing, organizing force. And I think that it generated capacity that we saw, well, immediately afterward at El Sabuktuk, right, where the protests over natural gas took place. And there were actual military, you know, forces there, snipers and stuff. Like, it was like, this is out of control. Like, this is Oka 2. As far as I'm concerned. And yet it's funny, we didn't treat it in the same way. I mean, it was not as many and not as intense military personnel brought to bear. But still, I thought the whole point of RCAP, the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, was to sort of like make sure that nothing even close to that happens again. So the rhetoric went.
I don't know. I mean,
some trace Standing Rock to that, because it was a precedent setting thing about, here's what we can do when we drive the narrative. So I think in ways that are explicit and implicit, Idle No More opened our eyes to what was possible. What is it? You know, somebody was asking me about, like, do you like something to the effect of recently, why do Indigenous people want anything to do with Canada? And I said, like, that's the weird thing. Many of them do. Many of them believe in Canada more than Canada does itself, you know, into its stated objective, its stated principles and values. And it's a bit of a head scratcher for me, because I'm just like, on the other hand, then I watch Indigenous hockey players play for Team Canada like they did for the women's team. And, you know, you get a little welt in your throat or whatever, and you're just like, wow, that's so awesome. So it's contradictory, but, you know, isn't that settler colonialism? I mean,
yeah, a lot of that's those contradictions and inconsistencies are a problem. You know, my grandfather was serious hardcore Mohawk nationalist, but also a Christian. I always thought that was a bit strange. Went to the residential school and I don't know, a little carried away some of that stuff, I guess, internalized it maybe, who knows.
I don't know more. I think awoke the interest and the sympathies, we'll see if it's the solidarities, right? If you get my drift, of non-Indigenous Canadians who are like, A, this is unjust, and B, you know, these peoples may actually have a better idea of how to approach how we live, how we organize our economy, how we treat the planet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the last thing you want to happen. I mean, I think, you know, in other words, I think Indigenous people are planting seeds in the minds of non-Indigenous people as to the questionable legitimacy of Canada as a country in terms of the as Art Manuel put it, I've been reading his rereading his book a lot lately, the Reconciliation Manifesto on legal quicksand. And the Supreme Court is, you know, doing backflips to try and maintain a place for Canada. But of course, it's in a serious conflict of interest, right? Like, why would a Supreme Court of Canada say, you know what, you're right. Like, you guys own the land.
Yeah. Did you ever interview Art?
No.
Never meet him?
No.
No, me neither. It's one of those people, and I think, gosh, now he's gone.
And but it's funny, eh? Like, he fits the role of those folks who, quote unquote, you know, lead from behind kind of thing. I mean, he was definitely there.
Yeah.
Front
he
and
wasn't
center.
Looking for attention.
Yeah, exactly. And
what was Russ like? You interviewed him. Oh, I haven't listened to that yet.
No,
that I've was a couple
him
years
a couple
ago.
Times. I interviewed him on climate change, and then I interviewed him about the splitting or cloning of Indian Affairs into the Department of Indigenous Services and the Department of Indigenous Crown Relations and Northern Development.
He's one of those guys. It's like we've been in the same room 100 times. I wonder if he'd even recognize me if he saw me. Another Mohawk guy, right?
Yeah. No, it's great to talk to him. I think he knows so much about what's going on, and I sometimes think he assumes everybody else sees it in the same way he does. And
really? That's not my impression at all. I thought he kind of sees himself as an outlier.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I'm not in a position to say.
I guess all I mean by that is like he sees it as baldly transparent that the Trudeau government
is
trying to do
true.
An end run around
true.
And has co-opted all the language that, you know, of reconciliation of nation to nation. And he's like, can't you see, you fools?
No, I think that's true.
He doesn't see it like that.
But Mohawks were kind of weird that way. We've got, we've got the two row wampum, the Gaswanta.
Right.
And I just find that we kind of think a little differently than a lot of other Indigenous groups in Canada. We're kind of the radicals,
I'm happy
the folks
for that.
Throwing up the roadblocks and all that. So I think most Mohawks kind of have that feeling like, oh, okay, well, not everybody sees it that way, you know, because there's this idea for the Haudenosaunee that if you say I'm Canadian or you identify with Canada in any way, well, you've gotten out of your canoe. You're in the white man's boat now.
Yeah.
And so you're a collaborator. I mean, I'm maybe exaggerating. It's a legitimate choice you can make.
Yeah.
If you want to say I'm Canadian and identify, but I don't meet too many other, like the Cree don't see it that way that I know of, or the Métis or anybody else. That's all I was getting at.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
Russ.
Yeah. But that's what I mean. I think, I guess, I can't put words in his mouth, obviously, but I think he sees some people all too eager, all too quick to allow further incursions on Indigenous people's sovereignty in exchange for a few more bucks for programs and services.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I know there's people out there who feel like, you know, this is all well and good, this high-minded sovereignty, stay in your own canoe stuff. But, you know, there are people who are in urgent need of right now, and that extra $600 million would make a big difference. It actually doesn't, but it, you know, do you want less money so you can stand on your high horse in your puritanical way? And I'm like, you know, really this, what you claim is better is really just a slightly different version of what's already been tried to date. Mm-hmm. When have we tried respect for title, rights, ownership, and jurisdiction of Indigenous people? When have we actually tried that?
Do you do a lot of interviews these days? I mean, you've got a roundtable panel sort of style program. You're doing your documentary. But
you mean like what you're doing to me?
No, the traditional journalism style. Not that you're not doing journalism, or we could talk about if you're doing journalism. I don't know. I have a strange relationship to that concept. I don't do a lot that I think of as really traditional journalism anymore, but
it's probably a good thing.
Yeah. But I mean, do you still kind of hanker to go out there and come up with a new story and sort of beat the bushes like a Jorge Barrera sort of, I said investigative journalism to him and he kind of slapped my hand for that. He says, no, all journalism is investigation.
That's what we all say.
It's a bogus term.
They make a distinction between enterprise journalism and then the journalism of press releases, right? You know, I mean,
right.
I think a lot of journalism is frankly just stenography. And I mean,
so you're not interested in that kind of stuff.
I would be, but you know, until they invent a cloning machine that works.
Right.
this podcast takes up
a lot of your time.
A lot of my time. So I'm doing it as a side hustle, but frankly, I've gone down to half time in terms of, working for an employer in order to grow the podcast. It would be my dream, ultimately, but it's playing out in the time frame it's playing out. You know, it started with zero patrons. Now it's 242. That took 106 weeks to get there, right?
Jeez.
So, but, you know, it's not been arithmetic growth? Like it has, right. There have been surges at times. So who knows? Maybe I'll be at 1,000 next year, you know?
There's Jesse Brown, right? Canada Land. My impression is pretty good. How much money is he pulling in?
I think
annualized. I'm sure you Googled it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Annualized, it's over $200,000, I think.
Annual, really?
I think. Well, we could take a little break here and do the math and check it out.
It's doing well.
It's in the tens of thousands per month.
But look what he did. It's a great formula, right? Worked at CBC, got to know tons of people on CBC. A lot of them lost their job, and now they're like, yeah, we'll talk shit about CBC and other things in the media. I mean, it's a great business model. It's just insider trading there or whatever. Yep.
Well, people are interested in how the sausage is made, right? I mean, they don't want to see they don't want to go to the abattoir, but they do want to.
What do you think is Canada Land?
What do I think of it?
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I mean,
you're a listener?
It's not, it doesn't hit it out of the park every week, but neither does it, nothing does, my show included. Although it may hit it out of the park for some listeners on some topics and then, you know, other topics. I don't know if anyone loves every topic, every discussion. All the time. I think his chief value is he's putting a critical eye. He's making people realize, wow, stories have storytellers. Storytellers have biases. Storytellers make choices. There's a corporate context. There's a profit imperative. There's shitting the bed on a constant basis out of the pressure to meet a deadline, or because there's laziness, or because of blinders, or because, you know, so all this stuff is being, you know, sweated out, brought to the surface. And I think that can be nothing but a good thing. You know, I mean, some people might complain and say, well, no one's going to trust anything journalists do anymore, as if that's a new, fresh concern. <Right. laughs> But, you know, they actually might have some sympathy if they understood the conditions under which journalists labor to produce journalism, right? Mm-hmm. So
I think people would miss it if it were gone. They'd suddenly realize, gosh. Now, you don't see that as competition or anything like that, though.
No, we do end up doing some media criticism. And now that we have Candace, a professor of journalism, I think it's going to come up more often. And in fact, she said, is it okay that I'm kind of doing a media critique? I'm like, bring it on. I think... We do it sort of implicitly, but I'm all for just putting it under the microscope. We just talked about the Chronicle Journal. That's the paper of record in Thunder Bay.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And they printed this horrendous headline about people throwing things at Indigenous people on the street. And
racially tinged, they
racially
call it.
Tinged, right? Yeah,
I think Tim Fontaine did something with that at Walking Eagle News.
He did, and so the headline was "Egg Tossing Incidents Have Police Scrambling."
Yeah, that was the headline. Let's make a joke out of
right. These are as far as I'm concerned, hate crimes, right? I mean, alleged hate crimes. They haven't been proven in court yet. And there was an inquest into to the death of seven students, right? Yeah. Over a certain period of time. And they reported how eggs were thrown at them. So, right? I mean,
See, that's what I was getting at earlier.
Yeah.
That when you write for, as an indigenous people person, and you write for a mainstream newspaper, if you use the word racism, they're going to make you put it in quotation marks.
Exactly.
Right? Or soften it. Racially tinged stuff. That's what I was getting at earlier.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just internalize that because, you know, they're not going to let me say colonial white supremacy or, you know, you just don't read those words in any newspaper of report.
Well, I don't want to spend any more time in my boss's office than I have to, right? I don't want any more ombudsperson's complaints to have to deal with than I have to. So,
have you had that kind of thing?
One time I made an off-color reference to the use of cocaine, and I got my wrist slapped for it. And I realized, I'm working for a mainstream outlet.
What do they do? They just pull you aside and say, "Don't do that again," or it would be a shame if they found you in the trunk of a car.
You couldn't make
those are lovely fingers you have, Rick. It'd be a shame if
it was sort of a look of like, really, Rick, you know better. And it's like, I guess I know better.
Okay, but, Dad.
But it's like, you know, are you really serious about, because the complaint was like I was making light of cocaine use.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like, you know what? Come on. This is a society that does not have a mature approach to the consumption of drugs, right? I mean, prohibition didn't work with alcohol. It doesn't work with any substance. Drugs have a place in every culture for millennia. Let's have an adult conversation about this. Let's pursue harm reduction. I mean, the abuse of any substance is a major problem. But sometimes humor is meant to kind of draw attention to things in a different alternative way, because I think it works on a different part of the brain.
Yeah.
And the thing is, everyone has to have, I suppose enough people have to have that sense of humor. But I mean, in any given population, some people just won't go there. And so the question then becomes, how do you treat that one complaint versus other people who say, like, that joke, you know, made me spit my breakfast out. Thank you for that. You know, I mean, and so.
To get back to the Thunder Bay Chronicle, I mean, it's just atrocious, the things that have been published there, you know.
So who's getting called on, right? So they issued an apology, but it was really like, it was short. It was, to me, it demanded a response of like, Indigenous people live in this region, and they are the disproportionate victims of horrific crimes. This city is sick, and we're part of this city, and we're going to take action on this. Like, we're a newspaper, right? Like, I mean, newspapers pretend they're at a distance from things, except when it, you know, when it comes to, you know, sponsoring parades and the like, and they want to be seen as a good, you know, corporate citizen and stuff like this. And like, you can't have it.
No, but that's such a good example, right? Because it's subtle. You would never have an Indigenous news agency running with that headline.
Exactly.
The Round Table, WayneKSpear.com.
Well, again, getting back to that question, what's in it for me? Like, you're thinking about that as a journalist or as an editor, as a publisher. Who are you imagining that me is, right? You're probably imagining somebody like yourself, unless you're a minority numerically, or you're Indigenous, or a person of color. You're like, the thing is, you're not thinking about it. Like, it's your water, it's your air, it's.
So do you feel that there are limitations within what you're doing? Or are there things that you'd like to do that you think, if I step too far outside of the format that I have and the way the show looks? Because you're in an interesting position now. I have never taken Patreon, on a Patreon account up. I've never taken any money, or I don't have a PayPal button or anything. Uh-huh. And I'm really reluctant, because the first dime that comes through the door, now you're accountable in some sense to your listeners. It's not a boss.
Yeah.
It's not a media company, but now you're taking money from people. So you have a responsibility now. You know, you can't just decide, I'm going to take 3 months off.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do a show, which I've done. And you can't say, You know what? Today we're going to do a show on Greek mythology, right? It's like, well, no, screw you.
That's not what I'm paying for.
I paid to hear about what's going on with indigenous people. I find that kind of terrifying and kind of, it's the same pull that I resist writing for, you know, CBC or whatever. Yeah. Like after Colton Bushy, I didn't want to, so I'm not going anywhere and I'm not writing anything for anybody because I feel like after what's happened in the past while with Tina Fontaine and other things, I feel like the last thing I want is to have to explain myself or how we're feeling to somebody who's going to say, well, maybe you should word that differently. Well, fuck you.
Yeah, right on.
So it's kind of the same thing in a way. You have shareholders.
Yeah.
You have accountability.
Yeah.
How free are you once you start taking money from people?
Well, the interesting thing is, I think if you approach it right, or with the right frame of mind, you realize every month people are going to sign up, people are going to leave, and you know you can't get too obsessed about either of those things, and you have to just keep making the show you want to make and go in the direction you want to make. I got into this to create a community, to create connections, connections between me and the four other people who constitute the roundtable, the roundtablers with the audience, and the audience with each other. Like we have a Facebook group that I'm really hoping people start to see it as an agora, to get really pretentious, but a place to kind of work out the stuff that they heard on the show and comment on it. And also for me, like I want to continue the conversations that start but don't necessarily end on the program, because frankly, almost as soon as the show's out, I'm like, oh, I should have said this, I should have said that. Like there's so much more to say.
Always.
Or I'd like to walk back this just a little bit and then walk to the side because I think I'm better articulating what I think. And so my ultimate goal is to actually foment this group of people. And I do say this on the website, meetindigenous.com, and that I really want to, it's going to sound pretentious, but I don't have another word that coming to my mind, like a movement of sorts of people who are like, I'm tired of getting, you know, either no coverage or superficial coverage or coverage that's like, you know, 90 seconds or maybe if we're lucky 4 minutes. Like I want to deep dive on this stuff, and I want to meet other people like me, you know. And
I totally understand. That's exactly how I feel. That's sort of my mission statement. What I'm doing is, you know, my favorite thing is just I'll be sitting in a bar or sitting in a pub and good friend, and we're just kind of chatting. That's sort of the model for what I'm doing. I always kind of imagine it in that way. And of course, when I was doing the roundtable, it was lubricated quite often. I'm not trying to create an agora. It's more like an Areopagitica. No. Is that a reason? Really?
Can I use my lifeline and phone a friend to find out what that means?
I just thought it was a really pretentious word. No, I mean, really, that's how I felt about it.
But seriously, what does that mean?
Areopagitica was a hill in ancient Athens for the exchange of ideas.
The more you know.
Well, I'm an English major, right? So I'm full of useless information.
I think I'm an English minor, yeah.
You went to university, you didn't finish?
I did. I went.
You did?
So I bounced around.
Political science.
Bounced around the University of Manitoba.
You're a political guy.
I certainly am. I went to the University of Manitoba, bounced around, took a bunch, basically all my electives. I started in fine arts, actually, and I realized quickly that that's not the place for me. Mm-hmm. And then said, oh, I think I want to do English because I like writing. Like I also kept a journal, by the way, like that early on in life.
I did that too. Yeah.
So yeah, to bring back to that. So yeah, the trifecta or whatever, you know, comic books, journal. And doing skits on the...
Well, back in the day, I mean, you couldn't create a website.
That's right.
You're basically looking at, I got to get a newspaper to publish my stuff or else that's about it.
Yeah, it wasn't until Carleton. I took a year off and went to Australia to find myself. And I was in the couch the whole time. No, anyway, isn't that joke about I found Jesus, he was in the couch the whole time.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing trip. And then I came back thinking, I want to get into politics.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But not like actual running for office kind of thing.
You know what?
You dabbled with it.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. I deluded myself into thinking so. And then I learned.
Premier of Manitoba right now instead of Brian Pallister. Damn.
Oh, man.
Did you see his selfie that he did on Twitter?
Yes. And it's like, my God, like, you know, like when you go out skiing and like all the snow refracts the sun. I'm surprised something like that didn't happen in that photo. That was nice and subtle, right?
Politics are pretty rough right now in Manitoba, aren't they? Well, I guess it always has been. When hasn't it been?
Yeah. I don't know where to go with that. Yeah.
No.
I mean, I think it was
interesting for me to go there and visit.
Yeah.
The first time I went to Winnipeg, because I grew up in Ontario, and first time I went to Winnipeg, it was just like, wow, there's Indigenous people everywhere.
Yeah, it's true.
It's cool.
I think a concept that I would like to flesh out one day, because I can only speak to it intuitively, is which city has the biggest Indigenous footprint? Not the most people, but the biggest footprint, like that you can feel their influence in the arts and politics and business, just walking on the street, you name it. And I would argue Winnipeg would be a contender for that.
I think so. Is there anything you wouldn't do on your show? You think, I'll give you an example.
Okay. Is it take money from Enbridge?
Yeah. Cause they called earlier and, got some reconciliation money.
Yeah, that's right. Reconcile your wallet with this.
Yeah. No, like people you wouldn't have on the show. You ever think, okay, I'm going to do sort of the crossfire sort of thing and we'll get a couple Indigenous people and I'm going to bring in, this seems to be the thing now in our world with social media. It's like people crossing swords and whatnot.
I
go back and forth on this because I think if you took some of those conversations offline and sat people on a table at a table here, it might be really interesting. And very few people seem to be doing that in a way that kind of advances the conversation. I'm not saying you should, but it's one of the things I think about. Bring some people. Would you bring people on the show who are maybe on the other side of some of these issues?
As long as you promise to not suggest names, I'll entertain this discussion.
Frances Widdowson. Oh, where's the line
she's on,
there?
She's been on my website.
Has she?
Yeah, there was this fascinating back and forth.
We have to compare notes. I've had exchanges with her online.
What we did was, this is on the website, so what we did is we published a piece by Negan Sinclair.
Yeah, he's great.
And I'm trying to remember what the topic was, to be honest, because it's years back. Like, Media Indigenous started as a group blog, as it were, like kind of an online magazine.
Yeah, you had people like Tim and Dan David.
And Hayden King and Hayden. Sarah Hunt. Wab Gishik Rice, Penny Cadron. Just awesome roster.
And good list.
If I've forgotten anybody, I'm sorry.
It's a long list. I've got it
Roberta
here.
Stout, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And it was kind of like a rotating crew.
Yeah, well, the thinking was if you can come up with one piece a month and there's like 10 of us, then that's a good amount of production. But you know what? People are busy. It seemed exciting at the time. I mean, it's almost like the version of the print version or the electronic print version of pod fading, right? Everyone's like, I love podcasting. Me and my buds sit around at a bar. We're pretty entertaining. Let's do this. Just press play and record.
Well, to use kind of a hackneyed word, you've got a platform.
Yeah.
And it seems logical to me that what you're really creating is something where you could at some point, and I've thought about this. I have reservations about doing it, but thought about really treating what I do as a platform. And you're in a great position to do that. So you have your guests on your show, but you open it up to guest posts, writing. I mean, you've done some of that with people like Robert Jago, who we can talk about. Great guy. He's taking a Twitter break right now. So he's incognito. Lots of panic there.
Chelsea Vowell too.
Chelsea too.
Taking a social media break.
It's a thing right now, which is really interesting because it's a lot quieter right now on my feed just with the two of them gone. No, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
But where I'm going with this is you could actually become an APTN on some scale, right?
Oh, the thought was right there from the beginning. Like I am ambitious, but I try to be realistic too. I mean, these things will unfold in their own time or not. And that's why, you know, like to be a journalist, there's many people like me who are in journalism and broadcasting. I guess I should be more inclusive there. They, on the one hand, are egotistical and self-centered enough to think that anyone would give a shit what they might have to say or think, or however, you know,
wouldn't be able to tell a story. Delusional, right? That way, right?
Right? But then on the other hand, I have within me like these raging insecurities. So in some ways I almost try to like, it's like this monster that I keep at bay with a stick. But on the other hand, I keep the monster around because it's like, I don't want to get too big for my britches. So I tend not to think of what I'm doing as a privileged space. It really is just a ragtag thing that, you know, I do, and I hope it has meaning for people. But on the other hand, I think if I really want to live up to these ambitions, I'm going to have to get really serious about it and in kind of a small C corporate way. That is to say, like, have an organization behind it, like really like put resources, human or otherwise, into it. And so it moves from a side hustle hobby to something, you know, that requires tending and work and but, you know, that transition is a big deal, and there's a lot of moving parts. And so,
sure. Who are some of the people that you're paying attention to and following and that are interesting to you right now?
Just anywhere and everywhere, and doesn't have to be just indigenous.
Favorites. We mentioned Robert Jago. I think he's on a lot of people's lists. Someone who's doing some interesting stuff. And a guy who, I don't know if you read, he had a post a few days ago, very thoughtful post about why he'd taken a break. And one of the things he zeroed in on is that he felt like being on social media was becoming a performance. He's being pulled in all these directions to speak in a certain way or write in a certain way. People telling him, you know, you're not hitting things hard enough, or who are you to, you know, to weigh in on this stuff? Other indigenous people, right? It's like, well, you know, that's your nation. You stay in your lane, kind of thing. So he's getting all this stuff. He's being on social media is affecting my writing offline. It's like, now I feel like I've got to perform to all of these expectations, some of which make a lot of sense, and maybe I need to think about them. And, you know, it's just a really interesting piece. And when you live in the world of media and it's a social media and online, you get these instant sort of feedbacks on everything. And I think you're kind of kidding yourself if you think it doesn't affect the work that you're doing, sometimes maybe in a good way, but sometimes maybe not.
Well, I mean, that's just another version of what you were talking about earlier. Like the one is a relationship mediated by money. The other one's a relationship mediated by attention. Like, I mean, attention is, you know, I mean, we can discuss whether, I mean, I guess that's what the debate is. The live debate is, have we moved to an attention economy?
Right.
Right. And I mean, in some ways you could argue, well, maybe that's what it's always been about. People have to feed this beast on a constant basis, because attention is finicky, right? I mean, and so, I mean, that was the principle which infused my approach, which was, I had done my homework and everything I read told me people respond to consistency. I'm seeing the appreciation, right? As new pledges come in, or sometimes pledges go up, and people want me to come speak to their group
See, that's fun. That's
it's good. Absolutely fun.
That's what I loved about it. I kind of missed, you know, just getting a call and say, hey, come out and do that kind of stuff. Fringe benefits.
Yeah.
Because what happens, it goes back to what you were saying about being part of a community of just interesting, creative, thoughtful people who are doing things. I think, like when I started this, I got to tell you this because this is how ridiculous I was. But, you know, when I started out as a young person, be like, you know, late teens, early 20s, and I had this romanticized kind of Paris in the 20s conception of working in media, right? It's like, oh, I'm going to write editorials for a paper, and I'll just meet all of these brilliant people, and we'll have fabulous dinner parties, and and we'll just solve the world's problems, and we'll go late into the night and talk about art and literature and the theater.
Sign me up.
And then you'd actually do it, and you realize mostly you're getting letters from unhinged people about, you know, what an idiot you are. And you're just thinking, geez, I didn't envision it going like this.
This is not what I signed up for. Yeah.
Listen, you, says Ted from Red Deer, Alberta, you fool, shake your head. thinking, this is not at all like my fabulous dinner parties. Are you working on other projects as well?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm working on the architecture, that the machine that supports all of that. I'm trying, because it needs to be ready to take on these larger things. I mean,
Rick Harp Incorporated.
Rick Inc. Yeah, no.
That's kind of catchy.
There Rick you go. Inc. So now that we have the lineup settled, right? Because that, and it took 2 years. Now I can enter a new phase where I start to entertain things like live tapings in different cities. I can entertain doing virtual summits. You know, Patreon has something called Discord, which is a means to do a live chat room with the patrons who support your show. So I want to look at those kinds of things to add and amplify the experience of connecting to the people who make Media Indigenous tick. I'd like to look at organizing conferences. I mean, every once in a while, like every couple of weeks, I'll see the latest, greatest conference organized by non-Indigenous interests about Indigenous peoples or about Indigenous topics. And these are like $500 to get in, right? So it's for corporate and government and bureaucratic audiences. And I'm like, these are just people, it's just a big circle jerk, everyone telling them what they each want to hear. And they may or may not have representative Indigenous participants. And I'm thinking, I want to pull together awesome Indigenous intellects and activists and people on the ground. And sometimes all, you know, some people fit all three of those things. Like, I just want people who engage, who understand and engage and try to change Indigenous rallies, to bring them together around these various topics.
I'll keep coming back to this. I think there's a generation coming up which just the terms of engagement and the rules of how things are done and public discourse is not what it was when you and I were coming up.
No, but it's funny. I really enjoy straddling the two eras.
Do you? Right? Yeah. I
got to see what was, and now I just feel like I have a front row seat to what's coming.
Yeah, well, I already feel, and I've said this to other people who are of my vintage. I said, look, you know, these are the people that are going to displace us and take over, and they are a serious bunch. They are not putting up with any bullshit. And I still do kind of fancy myself that way, but it's a whole, George Erasmus said back in 92, no, it was the, I think it was the 87 speech. He said, there's going to be a generation that's not going to want to sit down and negotiate with you. This is your last chance. And I think we're seeing that now. They're just people who are not taking prisoners.
Do you think we're going to see a day where there is no longer an assembly of First Nations, that we're going to see?
Yes. I think their days are numbered.
Yeah. What's going to,
or there'll be something that will come up and sort of rival them.
Okay. I was wondering, what's the process of change there? Who's the actors of change there? Is it, you know, cause it could just wither away or something else comes along. I mean, it's interesting. I was reading about Podemos, the kind of, you know, radical political group in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
They started through crowdfunding.
Really?
$150,000.
What a world we're living in.
I know. And it's funny. I wrote a piece on Media Indigenous. I said, I think the path to change could happen $1 or $2 pledges at a time.
Yeah.
Do a Kickstarter to create some kind of political entity that ignores the urban reserve artificial divide, as we do, and as AFN does not, because it can't, right? I mean, that's just how it's constituted. Or I suppose, you know, Russ Diable would beg to differ, right? And then, like, yeah, please do.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to romanticize the old days where, you know, people had to move around in secret because they weren't allowed to hire legal representation. They weren't allowed to advocate in any way, right? And there was kind of a quasi-pass system still going on, you know, but people would sleep on couches of other people as they moved across the country raising support, right? And I think that kind of raw, close to the ground organizing, I don't know, maybe that could be recombined with the amazing tools we have to collectively fundraise big campaigns. And I mean, that leaves it open to non-Indigenous people funding too.
So I went to a rally. I had a long history of political activism and, you know, grassroots stuff. I've written about it. I've talked about it.
Some of it you're not at liberty to say.
That's right. Sworn to secrecy. But you'd go to these things, you know, and I call them the usual suspects, the anarchists and the Marxist-Leninists. So I went to a rally in Toronto at City Hall for after the Gerald Stanley trial, the Colton Bushy murder. The Marxist-Leninists are there with their daily worker handing out their, and they're getting up and speaking. And I like to see the Black Lives Matter and Indigenous people are combining forces. But I'm quite aware that there's a lot of people that attach themselves to that with kind of an ambition to hitch Indigenous people and what we're trying to do to some kind of communist sort of revolutionary agenda. And I have kind of a history where I've seen, you know, people kind of take that over, say, you know, suddenly it's like, well, you know, is this about Indigenous people or is it about your anarchist aspirations there?
So they're doing what Trudeau does, which is co-opt the language, appropriate the language to their own ends, right?
Because I saw that with Idle No More. You know, the people at the front were sometimes the people I thought, well, it's not really about you or it shouldn't be about you. And I just know that that's part of, always going to be part of it. The bedfellows that, you know, they say nice things or they make the right noises and everything, but why are they there and what's their agenda?
Yeah.
And so, and I don't know what you do with that. It's just the reality of it. But it was one of the things that made me very standoffish when I was a young person about participating in what was then called radical politics. Because, you know, you knew the people who, they hated the man at the top, the prime minister or the president of the university or whatever it is. But when you kind of spent time with them, you realized they hated that the man because they wanted to be the man.
Yeah.
They resented the fact that they weren't the man. There was somebody else up there. Let's tear that guy down and then I'll be that person.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how that's done. And once you get the dynamics of a movement underway, it takes on a life of its own. And I'm not actually a revolutionary kind of person because you don't know what you're going to end up with. Who's the revolution? So that's just a generic kind of observation that applies to a lot of stuff.
Well, but doesn't that mirror where we are with the Indian Act, right? Because
it mirrors. It's a mirror. Because
people are like, we know what the Indian Act is about. Obscene and obtuse as it is. But when people talk about getting rid of it, like Trudeau did, wanted to, I'm talking about Pierre Elliott, people, well, what's going to replace it? It is entirely conceivable that what will replace it is worse, right? And so in some ways, it seems to me to be the same sort of dynamic that you're concerned about. It's like, everyone's like, tear it down.
Yeah. Nature abhors a vacuum.
Yeah.
So what's going to step in there? And I don't really know with Idle No More, because none of the solutions are really global. Like what Six Nations would want, their aspirations, is it captured by Idle No More? Or, you know, it might clear a space, or it might bring the government to the table on different terms, and there could be some value. I'd be interested to know what the Pampamateers and the Rusty Abos think about that. Because we haven't thought beyond the sort of the agitation phase. So we get on the streets and we rattle things and we make a noise. So, and then what?
You know, I mean, a context that I'm somewhat familiar with, but I wouldn't want to pretend to speak authoritatively, but I do note it with interest, is South Africa, right? And South Africa had a black majority or a non-white majority, right? And I'd often look at the dynamics there and look at it, because if they can't get the levers of power, you know, First Nations at 5% of the population never will, right? And so, but at the same time, there were still the challenges of transition from apartheid, political apartheid, to what we have now, which I think is frankly economic apartheid still. Like that was, and in many ways, that was the core of the, you know, the separation, the denial of opportunities and marginalization. You know, now we see in South Africa, they're attempting to reclaim or repossess the land, right? And, you know, everyone's sort of doing this sort of from the cheap seats quarterbacking. Was it couch quarterbacking?
Yeah.
Comparing it to what Zimbabwe did and all this kind of stuff.
The barriers are all, I think, psychological. They're fear. It's just the unknown, that sort of stuff. And we'll hate it. And I don't really think that's the case, especially when you consider that most Canadians live along that little tiny strip along the United States. And that's really all they know anyway. And the rest is psychology, which is interesting because, but you mentioned South Africa. It's really interesting to go back and to read white South Africans like Brayton Bock or J.M. Coetzee, like 5 to 10 years out prior to the end of apartheid. And you read that and they keenly understood that this was a psychological problem and a psychological transition more than it was an economic or material one. Just all of the shit in the heads of white settlers that they had never really processed about their relationship with black South Africans.
Well, it's really jarring to think that your existence is predicated and built on the marginalization of other people. I mean, that's why you have to come up with, as a society, you know, things like fear of the other.
Yeah.
You have to use the doctrine of discovery to justify, well, you know, they weren't Christian, and to update that a little, you know, they weren't using the land in a way that was, you know, they weren't cultivating, they, you know, and it's like, actually they were, but, you know, no, shut up. You know, so, you know, inventing all these intellectual, legal, political, philosophical, ontological, you name it, you know, acrobatics to just justify, you know, what in many ways boils down to force, you know?
Yeah.
You have what we want, you know, the great title of Thomas King's book, The Inconvenient Indian. Right. We're inconvenient. We're in the way.
Right.
And, but it's funny. I've recently come to be familiar with a situation, a case study about a community called Membertou.
Yep.
Which used to be in the heart of Sydney. You know, many decades ago, Sydney wanted to grow. Sydney wanted to expand. There was only one problem. There was these Indians in the way. So they forcibly relocated them, you know, far and away so that they were no longer in the heart of that area. Well, what happens when you do that? I mean, first of all, it's extremely traumatic, right? To be dispossessed and dislocated like that. And so Membertou was a basket case for a long time, right? At least this is the way the story has been told about Membertou because it's now a success. How did that happen? A number of things. They repatriated a lot of people who went away because there was no room left and said, let's try and make something of this place, even though it's not our place where we were. Right? A lot of people don't realize, like, a lot of cities and towns were first scouted, if you will, by first peoples, right? I mean, because they're like, why would you live on a reserve? A lot of people, like, they don't understand. It's like, well, you know, we just wanted to change. What? Come on. Like, we thought we could make something of this. Like, come on. Anyway, so they relocate Membertou. Membertou starts this repatriation movement of its brains and its talents. But they managed to get a gaming license. They managed to, swallow their pride and get some fishing licenses, right? The people who have occupied this part of the world for thousands of years having to go cap in hand, like, we have a license to fish. Is that okay, right? From the settler state. And so lo and behold, they start to have all these elements and they leverage the growth, the profits from that. And, I'm sure there's many people say there's a lot of, you're painting a rosy picture. I'm just relating a picture that's been rosied up by other people, but it has the ring of truth. It has the ring of truth, right? And here's where it's ended up. According to this case study, it is an economic driver in the region and where it exists. Sydney has now expanded to once again include this reserve community, and half the people that Membertou employs are, guess what? Non-Indigenous, right? Yeah. Probably a function of the fact that they're still training generations to take on these roles. But in the meantime, economic success of Indigenous people has ended up benefiting non-Indigenous people. Yeah. Kind of a cycle that's, you know, familiar, right? If you take the long view. And I don't know, we need to get more of that out there. And this is only something I kind of stumbled on because of some other need to research some stuff. I don't know why I felt I had to bring that up, but it's just, you know, if we can just get those kinds of things to destabilize the psychological fear of the other that has just entrenched itself in the minds of settlers, I think it just happens. You know, one anecdote, one podcast episode at a time, right? And I don't know. Like I said, you know, if I look back or look ahead and look, I don't know. This is sometimes I just got to keep my nose to the grindstone and just pluck away. But I do, you know, I do think it would behoove us to more often note where we've come from, and but we got to shake things up.
I did a show a couple weeks back, which was a little different because I just talked to a bunch of people on a topic, and the topic was identity, how you identify Canadian, Indigenous Canadian. What's the terminology? How do you think about identity? And I stitched them all together. I like the idea of doing kind of talk amongst yourself programs now where we're not talking across the aisle. And we're like, let's talk about what Ottawa did, or let's talk about this issue. We're always talking about issues. Instead, it was like, let's talk about more internal stuff.
Oh, okay.
That really is about where we want to go. What do we think amongst ourselves about? And you can get right down granular into your community or you know, your vision, your aspirations. And it's interesting because it's a much different conversation, because now you're not, you know, bitching about the usual thing. Yeah. The Trudeau government, which is fair enough. But
you now get it's the blue sky a bit.
Now you're like, yeah, let's talk about actually what we can do that doesn't require us to have any sort of to get funding or to have any sort of negotiation. I think that's where people like Russ are interesting, because I think he'd probably side with me on this. Is like, you can just go out and start doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're sovereign, or you know, you're in charge. Start doing it. Stop obeying the law. Well, you know, ignore Indian affairs. I don't know.
Well, we're at an interesting juncture, right? So somebody asked me recently, you know, why are things at where they're at today? They were talking about, it seems like it's only been recently that things have come to a head when it comes to Indigenous peoples really being assertive about what they expect to be able to do, what they are entitled to have a say in. And it really just seems to be, you know, the most forward, the most front and center it's ever been. And it's like, you know, what's changed? And I said, well, in the 50s, again, you weren't allowed to legally, you know, hire a lawyer. And, you know, as soon as we could, boom, we've seen a whole series of court cases. And as Candace Collison said on the podcast, you know, these chickens have come home to roost. Like, we now have a critical mass or a tipping point of the Supreme Court. And Art Manuel in the Reconciliation Manifesto echoes this. Like, basically, things have been pushed as far as they can go, and with the lateral insertion of UNDRIP into the conversation, right, which he calls the Indigenous Declarations of Independence. You know, it's really all of this is combined in aggregate form, I think, to really push Canada. In terms of how it justifies itself anyway, not necessarily in terms of raw power relations, but Canada's on its back foot, right? It's trying to come forward, and it's like, well, you know, this is where we could bring in the conversation around self-indigenization in a way. Like, there's a lot of people who are spontaneously becoming Indigenous who had never, ever had a claim to it before, and for various reasons seem to think it's to their advantage, or they have some kind of messed up notion of, you know, how DNA automatically transforms you into an Indigenous person. I think we're in very interesting times where we've pushed everything and we're almost kind of calling the bluff, right? It's only recently that I've come to realize, like, we're at probably one of the most interesting junctures. You know, at a certain point, we got to roll, quote unquote, roll up our sleeves. I don't mean like how Trudeau does when he goes to those farces of town halls, right? I mean, you know, get dirty here and put our minds together and really, I think, start every conversation or every thought process. This is not about Canada anymore. This is about us, right? And I have no idea what that looks like, frankly. I mean, I guess I'm doing that, right? Like, mm-hmm. in my own little realm. But, you know, maybe I think the function of Media Indigena, among other things, is to shine a light and help people connect who are making it happen for themselves in their own little pockets, in their own little way, whether that's just one person or a group of persons. And I think
anything I can do through Media Indigena to augment and amplify and draw attention, you know, signal boost, as they say, then I feel like that, like I feel like, you know, in life, we all want to know what we should be doing. And I think often we go down the path blazed by others thinking, well, that looked really cool what they did, but can I actually do that in a way that gives me joy, right? Because I think you need to do things, and I talk about this on Media Indigena, you know, there's this Venn diagram which connects, you know, things that make a difference, things that I'm good at, things that give me joy, and things I can make a living at. And we all need to find our own little ways of bringing that all together. Instead of us all thinking, oh, we all need to be lawyers, or we all need to be doctors, or we all need to be social workers, you know, like, yeah. I think there's room for everybody to be anything. And we need to find ways, though, to make those puzzle pieces fit together rather than continue to function in isolation. So I think we're at a time now where platforms enable that. And yeah, so that's me kind of just going on and on.
Well, it is an interesting time, and it's a good time to be doing what you're doing. I think you should keep going and keep at it, because they're important conversations, and that feels like a good point to end on, doesn't it?
I anticipated where you were going.
Not
my first rodeo.
Yeah. Rick Harp, thank you for being on the show.
It's been my pleasure.